Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mentoring Moments. I've got Alex and Daniel here from Flare, and we've just started working together, and these guys are building Flare, which is an awesome new Shopify app that allows customers to pre-purchase in advance their products on a given e-commerce website, and they're incentivized to do so. They're incentivized to plan their purchases, and they usually are incentivized through some form of a discount. And Alex and Daniel, we were talking about the UX, and we were talking about you've got some really good, hard, practical, quantitative data around, and through the A/B testing that you've done with your clients, you see a conversion rate increase of, I think you said, somewhere between 20 and 45% conversion rate increase for the option where your option of pre-purchasing and purchasing in advance is shown. And when customers are given that option, they convert at a much higher rate. And my initial thoughts and my initial feedback to you was, that's great, but how do we collect qualitative data in some way, or should we be collecting qualitative data in some way? Because what we can't measure easily through an A/B test is, what about the people that are forced to purchase now in the moment because they don't have the time to plan in advance? They don't have enough time between now and the time they need to start using the goods. Does that sour their taste on the brand? Yes, okay, I'm buying now because I have to. I see that I could have gotten a discount had I known enough in advance that was available. Then I could have planned a little bit better and I could have got the discount. So what does that do qualitatively around the feeling that a customer or potential customer has about a brand? And that's what I opened up about the discussion, because my initial gut visceral reaction to you showing me that workflow and that UI was, shit, what if I'm a person that's just stuck buying right now and I have no choice because it's last minute purchase because we talked about these earbuds, mine's died and I need a new pair straight away. But I feel maybe like I'm being penalized because I didn't have an opportunity to plan in advance. And so is that going to harm my perception of a brand because I'm not being incentivized to convert right away? And I use the example that almost every other app and almost every other UX component is designed to encourage people to convert immediately in the moment, whereas yours is actually incentivizing people to convert now, to close the sale now, but to effectively making buying in advance, to convert in advance of when the customer needs the goods. And I think we got to a point really quickly where we thought, hey, maybe we can expand this A/B test in a way that, okay, cool, we show it without the option to purchase in advance. We show it with the option to purchase in advance. And then the third would be effectively a multivariate test is, the third option would be the option to purchase in advance, but with a small message within the buy box, something along the lines of, help, you can help us be more sustainable by buying in advance, or something like that. That then when you click on that, it opens a modal, gives you more information. And you showed me an example of a modal that you guys have helped a brand design that gives a whole lot more information about the benefits of to the customer and the brand and the planet about buying in advance and not having leftover inventory, et cetera. And then we talked through, okay, what if in addition to that little message and piece of information, what if we could collect feedback in the moment for those that wanted to give feedback? What do you think about this purchasing option or something like that, where they could give feedback, almost like those feedback tabs that you see like with Feedbackify or Campile, that you can have that feedback tab on the page that people can slide out. They don't even have to, they don't have to be authenticated. They don't have to give their email address. They can just give their honest thoughts on something. And so we worked through that step by step. So I'd love to know your thoughts on that thought exercise that we went through.
I think it's really good. I think we struggled for a while with, not struggled, but I think as anyone building a Shopify app will know, you can go off the data, and I think the data is really important. As someone who's a former software engineer, like that's normally the number one thing you'd follow. But I think like how users feel is genuinely also very important, and something we were sort of battling over is, we speak to people who have used our product, so shoppers who've used our product and checked out with it. And we ask them all these questions around, why did you buy ahead? What was the most incentivizing piece? What didn't you like? What could have been better? And that's great. But we're only capturing a subsection of the entire visitors that came to that site and saw us as an option. And where we really, who we want to speak to is people who don't use our choice, because those are the people who will have the main issues with it. And we had no way of doing that. We couldn't collect their emails because they weren't purchasing. But I think what we could potentially be doing now, to your suggestion, Jason, is actually embed that in our UI somewhere, right? So it's not overwhelming, but it allows us to collect qualitative information from a visitor without needing their email as well. Because if you start trying to collect that information, it becomes so much harder to get it. So I think that's a great shout. And I think it's something we can definitely look to implement, because the feelings of the people that don't use our product are the ones we really want to address, right? And understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes complete sense. And I'm always about quantitative data absolutely has to rule the roost, but that qualitative data, it really, or at least giving the opportunity for someone to give their feedback, even if they choose not to, but just even opening up the opportunity and being a little bit more communicative about the benefits to them. And because we talked about the limbic brain, right, versus the prefrontal cortex, and the fact that what humans typically do, and this is in every psychological study shows this, we tend to make a very emotional decision first. And we, in the moment, we have almost our, it's almost a, we don't necessarily make decisions logically. Most of our decisions are an emotional decision. And then we justify that decision after the fact with our prefrontal cortex, right? That's the reality. We make almost an instinctive decision in the moment. So if somebody sees in that buy box, they see the opportunity to get, say, for example, a 15% discount if they can buy 60 days, 2 months in advance, they have the opportunity to do that. They can wait for their goods. They're going, geez, of course I can wait for this. I don't need it right this moment. Cool. I also get a discount. Awesome. Boom. That's going to cause me to add this to my cart. Let's do this. But then they also have to justify their decision after the fact and say, why did I do this? I don't want to feel like I did this just because I got this discount. I also, if I also can have the feel good, warm and fuzzies inside that, oh, and I'm also at the same time, I'm being more sustainable, because there's a lot of evidence out there and there's a lot of data out there to show that sustainable brands, if their sole value prop is to be sustainable, if we look at somebody like Allbirds, for example, we know that people say they want to buy sustainable products and off of sustainable brands, et cetera. But what the data shows is that 9 times out of 10, if the sustainability play is the only play that a brand has, and they're significantly more expensive than their competitors or whatever, then they are usually going to lose in the marketplace. What people say and what they do are two different things. So out of one side of our mouth, we say we want a more sustainable future, but out the other side of our mouth, what we're doing or where we're putting our money down, and when we put our money where our mouth is, we buy the cheapest good or the cheapest good that meets our needs. And so we're motivated by lots of other things other than just this altruistic sense of sustainability, right? And so I think that, but if we can use sustainability to justify our actions or a decision we already wanted to make anyway, and we can justify it after the fact, then that makes us feel better about our purchase. And it makes us feel better about the brands that allow us to purchase in that way and make it easy for us to justify our buying decisions, I guess is the thought process we went through, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it comes down to what is the reason a brand is adopting Flair as a technology, and what is the motivation behind it? What are the benefits for the business? What are the benefits for their customers? And what is the benefit for the planet? And I think what's really unique here, and I think that's what you were suggesting, is there is a big tie between the financial benefits to a business, the financial savings you can offer your customer, and then the savings you can make from an environmental perspective from reducing that excess stock. And it's where brands will move over the next few years to say, okay, we're not just saying we're sustainable. We are giving our customers more choice. We are using this data to minimize excess stock. We're saving money as a result of that. And so when we talk about sustainability, we really mean it. And that's why you should come shop with us, because we're actually taking action where we want to be.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. I think the great thing about Flair is it creates a win, right? Or it can create a win. It creates a win for the brand. It creates a win for the customer, especially the customers that can afford to wait for a product or order in advance. And it creates a massive win, not necessarily in it for the environment. I think there is a win for the environment, but I think it also, more importantly, it creates a scenario where a brand doesn't need to overproduce and then ultimately end up discounting cut the guts out of that product to move that product into scenarios where it's more of a want and less of a need. And so we can now service needs first and wants as a secondary consideration. And I think this is, and I think being able to communicate that really simply and elegantly through the Flare UI is where the challenge is. I think that's the only thing. And I think there's probably ways we can even A/B test the messaging. That one simple sentence, it could take 4 or 5 or 10 different forms. And you never know that just the structure of that one message and then the modal or the landing page that gets that you get dropped into, if you want to learn more, I think that can have a massive impact on conversion too. So I think there's probably a few different tests we can run here. And I'd love to also know whether there's a strategic partnership opportunity, a technical partnership opportunity here with a platform like Nibble. I don't know if you guys are aware of a platform called Nibble, where you can negotiate discounts, et cetera. There may be an opportunity here to do a strategic partnership with them where you combine your technology together in the one widget where people can negotiate for the discount depending on how far in advance they can purchase. So there may be some strategic opportunities here to collaborate together and bring the benefits of, because I think both of your technologies are really interesting from a UX perspective. And I think there are definitely some synergies between you two guys. I've had those guys on the podcast before. I may have to make an introduction and you guys can have a conversation about how you can collaborate together.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jason.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Mentoring Moments. I'm here with my man, Ivo, once again for one of our mentorship sessions, and he's got a solid agenda lined up for us today, and he says he's happy to share with the wider world from his learnings. So over to you, Ivo. What is on your mind today?
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, buddy. I'm very happy to be here again.
It's been a couple of weeks, man. In fact, I think it's been almost a month since we caught up. So yes, we've had a few things going on in each of our lives, but it's good to see each other again.
Exactly. Same here. And I'm very happy to be here again. I'm looking forward to this session. And I've picked out the topic bringing us to the very beginning of e-commerce. So when does a business or when should a business engage into digital commerce? And it sounds like a simple question, right? But it's not a trivial question. It's quite the opposite. It's such a significant question because it's a strategic shift into how a business operates. And it has so many dependencies, right? You need internal resources. You need digital know-how. Maybe there's an industry trend that forces you to do things. But with your experience, with your knowledge, having been on both sides of the fence and being a consultant in that space, Jason, question to you. How do you see this question and what would be your answer here?
So if I understand you correctly, the question is, when should a brand or a business go into the channel or deliver the channel of e-commerce and try to excel in that channel? Am I understanding that question correctly?
Yes.
I would say that in almost all instances, I'm not going to say 100% because there's always exceptions to any rule, but I would say that as of 2024, particularly if it's a startup business, that e-commerce, and let me preface this by saying, if they are a physical goods retailer. Now, sometimes digital goods people, obviously you can sell that via e-commerce, you can sell that in multiple different ways. But I would say that anybody, whether that's B2B, B2C, D2C, doesn't really matter. As of 2024, selling online is mostly just table stakes. It's absolutely foundational to any business today. It would be very rare, and we even see it in the retail world where the likes of Primark and H&M, and there was a number of retailers, particularly pre-COVID, that staunchly rejected and refused to do e-commerce. Mm-hmm. H&M famously said, we're going to do click and collect. That's probably as far as we're ever going to get with e-commerce so that people can buy online, pick up in store, because they had such a massive investment in their store estate that they felt that was their differentiating factor, was the fact that they had this level of in-store service that allowed them to have much higher, for example, AOVs than what they thought they could ever achieve online. But we've seen every single, I'm not aware of any major brand that even pre-COVID said, we will never do e-commerce, that isn't doing e-commerce now. Primark, H&M, they all caved. They all realized that, geez, okay, during the pandemic, when people couldn't come to our stores, we have to have digital routes to market. And we've seen the dominoes just tumble one after the other. It's so funny when these boards, I used to read some of their shareholder letters at the end of each year, and it just used to baffle my mind when they just were so resistant to digital channels of any variety. Many of them were also resistant to marketplaces. Many of them have also been resistant in the wholesale sector to doing anything that would resemble self-service e-commerce other than EDI and punch out or e-procurement in the B2B world. So EDI and e-procurement has been very common in the B2B world, at least for the biggest buyers, for many years, for probably 15, 20 plus years. E-procurement has been a really big deal in the B2B world because they want to automate a lot of that transaction cycle.
All right.
But latterly, e-commerce has, I'm talking self-service e-commerce here, has become, I would consider it table stakes even in the B2B world now. I don't think you can be a hyper successful player. You may be very entrenched. You may have somewhat of a monopoly in your region or your vertical or your category. However, I just don't think that those monopolies will hold up moving forward against digital pure plays that come into your market nowadays. I just don't think you can withstand that forever. You may be able to bumble along, but I think it's very difficult to grow a business today without being, without at least being omnichannel. We know for a fact that 70 to 80% of all retail spend still goes through physical stores. We do know that. I'm not here to say that e-commerce is taking over the world, because it's not. And the reality is it's still massively up and to the right, but it's growing off of a fairly low base. That's the reality. So even if we're growing it, even if we're growing at 10% a year, compound annual growth rate in the retail sector, for example, and it's more like 20% is the forecast, 19.5, somewhere between 18 and 22%, depending on the data that you look at, is the forecast for compound annual growth rate of e-commerce for B2B between now and 2030. Now, when we look at retail e-commerce, the forecast is anywhere from, I think, 4% to depending on the part of the world that we're in. So it's still up and to the right. It's still growing at a much faster rate than physical retail, but physical retail just absolutely dominates a retail spend. So I don't think, as much as I am a hardcore e-commerce fanatic, and I think it is transformational for businesses in so many ways, and it's transformational for their customers. And even in a multi-touch attribution environment, we know that the data says that even if your online sales are only 10% of your revenue, say for example, or 5% of your revenue, that it contributes to your offline sales as well, because people will go there. They will do their research, they will search online, then they will go to a store and they will complete a purchase. In fact, it's interesting. I have a podcast episode coming out tomorrow, which is all about a tech platform called Locally, L-O-C-A-L-Y. And they're based in the United States. And they have been building a digital marketplace for e-commerce merchants that is exploded onto the scene because they are focusing 100% on a marketplace of click and collect. Mm-hmm. So very similar to the type of technology that you're delivering, very similar, but it is all about taking inventory feeds from hundreds of retailers across the United States. Okay. And then And it's all about their physical store inventory. It's not about online fulfillment. It is about where is a place that I can go online and either purchase online, pick up in store, or literally just walk in off the street and complete my purchase. And the challenge is that a lot of customers are in a position where they want to do their research online, but they literally have a requirement to pick it up right now in store. And I when I was doing the interview with the owner of this company, I gave the example was when I was recently in the United States and I was on a business/pleasure trip. And I was going up the coast of California with my wife and I wanted to buy a new laptop, but I wanted to buy it in person because every single day we were in a different place.
Sure.
It wasn't like I could just say, oh, can you deliver this sometime in the next 3 days to this address? Because I needed to be able to walk in, literally pick it up off the shelf and walk out with it. And a lot of places, a lot of retailers either don't show inventory online of their physical stores or it's not accurate inventory. This is another major problem. Either they don't show their store inventory online or if they do show it, they show just in stock or out of stock. They don't show the quantity of inventory that they have at that store of that SKU. Okay. Yeah. Or their inventory is massively out of whack to where you just can't trust it, to where they might say they've got it in stock, but you walk in the store and they definitely don't have it in stock. And so usually in these cases, you need to ring first and you need to say, you say you've got this item in stock, but do you really? Can you go and put your hands on it for me and set it aside for me, even if I need to pay a deposit over the phone? And so there's a situation here where I think a lot of manufacturer brands, they are missing out on the opportunity to drive foot traffic to their retail stores and vice versa. The visibility of a physical product in a physical space dramatically increases the reach of that brand because of the fact that 70 to 80% of all purchases are still done in a physical space. So we know that the data says that if a brand online drives traffic to retail stores, obviously that's good for their brand because they then have their products in places where customers are already buying, and vice versa. It drives direct-to-consumer sales through their branded website because people are seeing it out there, and it drives demand for that brand, and it creates massive amount of brand recall the more that someone sees that product out in physical spaces. So we know that it cross-pollinates sales.
But would you say this also holds true for B2B?
Because 100%.
Okay. Interesting. But would it be for distributors and vendors or also for brands? Because also brands, they would probably not be in those locations where there is a lot of footfall.
Correct. However, once again, we have many B2B retailers today are now omnichannel, meaning that they have physical stores, not just online distribution, right? So they've literally got physical stores where you can go in and you can buy bearings and you can buy pumps and we've got industrial supplies. We've got pretty much almost everything that you can think of that is in the B2B world. There will be some place that you can go and buy physically, but they don't call it retail sales. They don't call it click and collect. They call it will call. So it may be literally physically going to a B2B warehouse to pick it up. And they just have a counter out the front of the warehouse where you walk in, you've made the purchase online and it's called will call. It's literally got the will call sign over the door and you walk in and it's a dusty, dirty warehouse, but they've got the counter there to where they could just hand it over the counter to you, right? So there's much more, this is much more common in the B2B world that their physical stores are actually their warehouse locations. And it's much more common in the B2B world. But some of them have really proper physical store chains with like proper point of sale equipment at the front to where you don't have to order it online and then go in for will call pickup. You literally can just walk in, say, I need this for this project. I need these 15 items. Do you have it? Cool. I can pay with my business credit card or I can just put it on my account, my trade account, literally at the point of sale. I guess I said all this to say that we know through multi-touch attribution that buying journeys are non-linear today, meaning it's not just a customer decides, I want to buy this product, so I'm purely going to go to an online store or I'm purely going to go online, search for it, buy it, add it to my cart, and check out. That there are usually more than 3 to 4 touch points. It could be an organic listing in search. It could be a performance ad, so they could see an ad, whether it be on Meta, Google. It could be an ad on Amazon. They will oftentimes go and search on marketplaces. They will go to a DTC website. They'll go to a physical store. There are usually 3 to 4 touch points with a brand before someone executes a purchase.
You also have the brand website as well.
Correct. And we also have the brand manufacturer's website as well, if they're not one and the same and it's not a DTC website. And so the reality is that the buying journey is more fragmented, I guess is what I'm trying to say, than ever before. And the data shows this. And so what we do know, and I just think of it in my own life, right? When I'm going to buy something, I'll usually try to compare, you know, options. You rarely am I looking for just this one specific product. I'm saying, okay, I need a new pair of running shoes, for example. And I just bought my first ever pair of Adidas running shoes, right? Now, I was originally looking to buy a pair of Nikes because I'm a hardcore Nike fan. I've had Nikes my whole life. And my latest pair of Nikes is worn out because I've put so many kilometers on them. And so I started my search in Google. Then I also looked on Amazon. And what I found is that through the Nike website, at least here in Mexico, and through Amazon Mexico, that the Nike range that was available to me online was very limited. All right. First of all, I didn't like any of the styles and designs. The prices were outrageously expensive, and it was going to take a while to get to me. And so I did do an online search across multiple channels, retailers that carry Nike themselves and Amazon, right? I didn't find anything I liked at a price point that I was comfortable with. So what did I do? I then expanded my search and I was like, okay, what other running shoes do I think I would potentially like? Then I started searching for Adidas, right? So then I found a pair that I really liked. I liked the style of, I liked the design of. It was 25% less expensive than the equivalent Nike. And I could get them through Amazon and they said that they would be able to deliver them within 2 days. Wow. And I was like, job done. Yeah. So ordered them, arrived in 2 days. I was over the moon, loved them, super comfortable. And so Nike lost the sale because it was hard to procure them. They were expensive and they didn't have any styles available that I liked. Right. And so I know people like to say the guys don't care about style.
Guys with style do.
Exactly. And I wouldn't consider myself a style icon by any stretch of the imagination, but I do have to like what I put on my feet. And I have to like what I see when I look down at my feet. And the reality is they lost the opportunity to close me in this particular instance because of the difficulty of getting the product and the difficulty of getting a product that I like, right? And so I think this just points back to the fact now I do about 90%+ of my purchasing of my retail spend online. Now I realize I'm an anomaly. I probably am a little bit more representative of guys than I am women, obviously, because guys tend to enjoy shopping, just the act of shopping, browsing, walking into stores less than females. Like my wife, she'd be quite happy to walk through a mall and just browse, just walk into the stores, may not buy anything, but she just likes the act of shopping. Yeah. But me, I have to be, I shop with a purpose. I don't just randomly browse Amazon to see if there's something I might like. I go there with a purpose. I go there with a need. And I've spent probably $1,500 on Amazon in the last month because we're kitting out our new house here in Mexico. So I bought a whole house air purifier. I bought a crock pot. I bought a toaster. I bought an air fryer. Like I'm buying stuff now that we're actually settling in. We need to build the stuff that you need to have a comfortable lifestyle and be able to cook in your kitchen and things like that. And because trust in Mexico, in just retail in general, trust is very low. And therefore, the trust factor with Amazon is very high. All right, okay. And the interesting thing here in Mexico is that many of the addresses, the addressing system here in Mexico is very complex. And there are many addresses that are not on main roads, meaning that they are off of their walkway addresses. So when you go down a walkway that's off of a main road, it could be a rabbit warren of walkways that there's many addresses that are not connected to a main street in any way, that they have a pathway address. They do not have a roadway address. And this makes finding addresses here exponentially more difficult for delivery drivers because they have to then park on the street. Then they have to find the alleyway. Then they have to find the address on the alleyway. So it's a challenge. Getting stuff to your door here is a challenge. But Amazon has somehow managed to crack it, and they will deliver up to 9. I've had Amazon drivers come to my door at 9 p.m. at night. That's how hardcore they are about getting products to your door here. So I have a seriously, I have yet to have an Amazon delivery here in Mexico go missing. So I have an extreme amount of trust in Amazon that they're going to get me the product. They're going to get it to me within the time that they say, and it's going to be the item that I was sold, that it's going to be accurately represented, that what I receive is what I thought I purchased. So I said, this is a roundabout way, but I'm saying that every place in the world does things slightly differently, but I think that e-commerce is increasing, and e-commerce is only 9% of retail sales in Mexico. It's bugger all. So in the States, it's 25, encroaching upon 30%. In the UK, it's about 30%. I don't know what the percentage is in Germany. I would assume it's probably around that 25 to 30% mark. The rest of Europe is slightly lower than the UK. UK is the highest in Europe in terms of e-commerce penetration. But when I spent all this time in New Zealand, pre-COVID was about 9%. Now it's about 13 or 14% percentage of retail is e-commerce. So it's growing fast. Even countries that are starting off of a very low base, there is that, I think, presents the bigger opportunity for e-commerce because it's an immature market, right? And so you have a greater opportunity to build a moat around what you're doing because there's less competition. In the US and the UK, two very mature markets, hyper-competitive, Amazon dominates. It's an interesting situation. But I think that nowadays, especially because of the multi-touch and multi-touch point impact of offering e-commerce, that starts to become seriously impactful, even if you're selling via retail.
And thank you for your answer, Jason. I'm looking at tying it a little bit back to B2B, where I see massive amounts of websites and brands that only offer, they don't offer an online shop, by the way, in most cases, then they offer a contact us form that you need to fill in that probably no one uses because I can't remember the last time I've filled in a contact us form. And then some might have a registry of their vendors. So where do you see from your experience the biggest challenges? What are the biggest challenges if you were to rank the top three challenges of businesses to implement e-commerce? Where do you see those?
I think it's, especially in the B2B world, it's still a mindset issue and it's still a leadership issue, right? Mm-hmm. We have, in many cases, not all, but many cases, we have male, pale, stale boards. So we've got an older generation of these B2B business owners. They come from a background where B2B was dominated largely by monopolies, meaning that manufacturers would often grant distributors regional monopolies. They'd say, if it's in the United States, we'll have a West Coast distributor that owns all distribution of our products on the West Coast of the United States. We'll have an East Coast distributor, and then maybe we'll have a Midwest distributor, for example, or a Central States distributor, for example. And they own all that. And any inquiries that come in from those catchments, we're gonna refer directly to our distributors in those regions. And they would grant exclusive distributorships. And sometimes those would be lifetime. Sometimes they would be 1 year, 5 year, 10 year exclusive distributorships, whatever. And so these distributors didn't have a massive incentive to make it easy to buy through them. Because if you wanted the product, you had to go through them. You had no choice. But with the advent of more and more manufacturers establishing D2C channels in competition with their distributors, and now because most manufacturers realize that distributors also can behave better or worse depending on incentivization and competition, they're saying, okay, we're no longer going to give exclusive distributorship. If you want to distribute our product, that's fine. Here's our MOQs. Here's how much stock you have to hold, et cetera, et cetera. Here's our rules if you want to become a distributor, but it's going to be open to competition. It's not going to be exclusive. So you better add some value as a distributor beyond just holding stock of our product in a local warehouse. You got to add more value than that. Sorry. And we're going to make sure that our pricing in the distribution market stays competitive by making sure that you can't basically do monopoly rent seeking as the master distributor. We're gonna keep competition into the market by having multiple distributors of our product. So I think that in the B2B world, it's mostly a legacy mindset issue that we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a legacy industry, but I'll tell you what, it's interesting just how fast manufacturers and distributors will change their tune when a pure play digital player competitor comes into the market. All of a sudden, it puts the fear of God into them, especially if someone absolutely nails their digital service offering and offers EDI, punch out, e-procurement, self-service e-commerce. If they're just absolutely cutting edge on their digital services, their digital commerce services, it is amazing how fast it can change an industry. And it puts pressure on these legacy players, and they've got no choice. Secondly, so we've got the first thing, which is mindset and a legacy thinking in the industry. And a legacy, there's some structural challenges to the B2B space that we need to overcome still. And that's what we're dealing with here from a mindset perspective. But then the next, there's two additional things that I see on a regular basis. They are tech averse oftentimes, or they're tech neophytes. They're not digital natives oftentimes. And it means that they do not have the technical chops inside the business to be able to understand even how to go about architecting the right solution for them. So maybe they've got an ERP and that's it. That's what they run their entire business inside their ERP. So maybe they have an IT team. Maybe they've got one ERP admin inside the business that's really skilled, or a business systems administrator that kind of owns that IT side of the business. And ERP typically falls under that IT umbrella within the business. And then maybe they've got someone in the business, or maybe they have a IT service provider that does all their like business desktops and laptops and networking and all that internal like file sharing and all that sort of stuff inside the business. And that's as technically adept as they are, and that's it. And maybe a WMS to manage their warehouse or whatever. Yeah. And all of a sudden now they have to start thinking about systems that they have no knowledge of, no experience of, and they've got no capability inside the business to be able to even go out and do search and select for the technology. The final stumbling block is capability around digital and e-commerce in particular, combined with knowledge of B2B. So usually these businesses, they've got people obviously that know B2B inside and out, but they don't have digital capabilities. Or if they look to hire someone from the market, it's like trying to find a unicorn. If you try to go and find an e-com manager or a head of digital or a CDO that has digital chops and B2B knowledge and background, that's a unicorn. And you're going to be paying them a fortune, because most of those people have gone and either working in agencies or started agencies, or they're a consultant or whatever the case may be. So usually what they have to do, they either have to train someone up inside the business in digital skills and do some knowledge transfer with some partners and agencies that they work with and do some training and get them upskilled. Or they have to go and find someone from the market who's got digital chops and e-commerce chops that they can then nurture and upskill and train in all the nuance of B2B, and specifically B2B in their vertical and their category and their business and their go-to-market. I'm seeing both happen, but those are the three layers that we're dealing with here. And there's probably a fourth layer there, which is massive resistance by sales teams. But usually I can, because they feel threatened, I can overcome that within 30 minutes of spending time with most sales teams. I can get them absolutely fired up about e-commerce and digital channels and digital routes to market. So that's becoming easier to overcome, I think, but it's leadership and mindset and structural challenges in the B2B world and legacy thinking. It's a lack of technical capability in the business, because they usually are used to dealing with IT systems only, heavy duty back office business systems only, if that. And then thirdly, it's where do the skills come from to be able to build that muscle, that digital muscle? Where are the skills going to come from to build up that capability within the business? So those are the big three.
Excellent. I actually took down some notes. And these are actually quite difficult challenges to overcome, right? Mindset is you would probably need a coach, or you would need to have the motivation to get out of that rabbit hole where you think, okay, this is it. Or you mentioned also long-term relationships with your vendors and distributors. Pardon me. If it's a contractual relationship, you are stuck by a legal binding document. Now, the last question, last follow-up question, we discussed, okay, what are the what is the status quo of B2B businesses to go into e-commerce, then the challenges. So what would be the triggers for them to actually, what is generally the trigger? Is it what you mentioned earlier, that if there is a digital pure player competitor coming in where they would change it, or is it the hurdle of implementing e-commerce? Because although there are platforms like Shopify, or by the way, NextCommerce, but is it the hurdle that it's maybe for them, it feels that it is so difficult to tie up all their existing, maybe legacy infrastructure and platforms, internet platforms, to tie it up with a shop system? Or where do they fear to make the step into e-commerce?
There's three triggers. There's three common triggers that I see and that I'm recognizing. One is board members, CXOs, et cetera, die, they retire, their kids take over. There's still a lot of family-owned businesses in the B2B world that are multi-generational family businesses. And you'll get a child or a grandchild that now has grown up in the business and they take over. They become the CEO, they become the CMO, they become the CTO, they become the CIO, whatever it is, CDO. And all of a sudden they go, I'm a digital native, so we're going to offer digital commerce. It's that simple. And so they get elevated and they get promoted within the business and they just push out the old fogies. And because they're digital natives, it becomes natural for them to offer digital routes to market. That's one of the biggest triggers I see. The second one is competitive pressure. So competitor digital, either pure play or really strong omnichannel competitor enters the market. They have no choice but to try to keep up and build additional digital moats around their business. The final one is customer pressure. The customer says, we will find a new supplier if you do not offer us e-commerce, if you do not offer us EDI, if you do not offer us e-procurement directly connected to our procurement system. If one of those three, the biggest players will require EDI, the biggest buyers will require an EDI connection. Typically, the medium size buyers will require some sort of form of e-procurement connector into their procurement system where they dynamically generate a PO and effectively it's shunted into an e-procurement system. And then the medium and small size buyers will typically require self-service e-commerce. And so it's customer pressure that is, and customer pressure is the best form of pressure, really, because the reality is if someone new comes into the business or a child or grandchild gets promoted up through the business and it becomes a top-down affair, oftentimes it's like pushing shit uphill because now they've got to digitally transform the entire organization and they're going to get resistance from all across the business, or they can get resistance from all across the business. So bottom-up transformation, which is driven by customer demands and requirements, that's where businesses will usually transform the fastest because they're going, hey, our customers are threatening to leave us if we do not offer these digital channels, the sales channels and digital support channels to them. They're going to find a new supplier. That's the best form. Yeah. Bottom up, customers putting the asset on you, that will cause a business to change faster than just about anything else.
Because that's your bread and butter, right?
If it's threatening your very existence as a business, then you'll move pretty quick.
Excellent. Loved it. That's exactly what I was hoping for, to get out of this mentorship session, and loved every single minute of it. Excellent. Jason, as always, it was a pleasure.
If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.